Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Let's get into it. Hey, you're listening to the Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl book club. Let's get into it. Song for someone. You're waiting for one man, but you're exchanging glances and half smiles with another man, bald, who sits alone at the corner. A third man, a stranger, walks to you, stands over your table and offers to buy you a drink. T-Pain. Your teacup is halfway up when he speaks. You pause for a second, then glance at the stranger as you sip. When you reunite the cup with its matching saucer, you say, "No, thank you." You flash a smile which you hope is polite, non-bitchy, but also non-flirty. This is important. Also, you smile because you want to let him down gently without bruising his ego in front of his friends. You'd notice he'd come from a table where two other men sat drinking and watching both of you. The man pulls a chair opposite from you and sits. His perfume, some expensive oud which he had overdosed on, chokes you, healing the soothing scent of the ginger tea which you'd been drinking in. He drops his car key fob and phone on the table casually, but strategically placed for you to notice he drives a Mercedes-Benz and has an iPhone XS. I hope you don't mind. I do, actually. I'm waiting for someone. He leers like you just told him you wanted to blow him. He has the air of a man who expects everybody to be as enamored of his good looks as he is of them. He puts his elbow on the table and clasps one of his fists in the other. You remind me of, you don't hear the rest because you think Usher, and you do a quick scan of his songs in your mind's jukebox selection. You remind me, and start singing in your head. It's something you do. Remember songs and lyrics when people talk and sing in your head while tuning out the people you don't want to talk to. You're in the middle of the second verse when you realize he stopped talking. You cut the music and stare at him like, what? You're not paying attention, he scolds. Now you want to roll your eyes hard enough to dislocate them. Instead, you say, please, if you don't mind, I'd like to be left alone. Your tone is even, respectful even, low enough so it doesn't carry beyond your table to within earshot of the other people in the almost empty restaurant bar of the golf club. The bald man watches intently from his corner. You should be nice to me. I can take care of you. You massage your temples gently while doing a slow head shake. You close your eyes for a moment. Look, Kel. You open your eyes because he calls your name, or rather a shortened form of your name. My name is Yukela. There's a hardness in your voice. He shrugs. Whatever. Then he leans forward, half shuts his lids, making his eyes bedroomy, dreamy. I want you, he draws. Let's stop playing games. I'm rich and I know what you are. He half puckers, then licks his lips like LL Cool J. I'm willing to pay whatever you want. How much? Things have happened to you when you waited for men. Like the time 7 years ago with Victor. You were alone on a table at the poolside of Blue Elephant waiting for Victor, your fiancé. He was running late, but you'd ordered the grilled prawns and fries for him because that was what he always eats at that restaurant. You weren't hungry and you nursed a Sprite to pass the time. It was dusk, Thursday, 10th March 2011. You remember the date because your traditional wedding was scheduled for Saturday that week and the church wedding for the next Saturday. You were 26. You glanced up from your phone and saw Victor striding towards you fast. You started smiling at him when you glimpsed Anele, his best friend, anxious, running to catch up with him, but he didn't catch Victor before Victor reached you. Actually, Victor's roar of sloth reached you first. A half second later, his big bright hand slap grabbed your throat and half lifted you from the seat. His face was twisted into a snarl and he repeated his greeting. Ashao. You'd met Victor when he gave you a job in his architectural firm, just after you got your M.Arch. He was a sweet gentleman with a booming laugh which bounced off walls and shook everywhere he went because he laughed often. He was smitten by you. It took 1 week for him to shed his pretense of professionalism and ask you on a date. You turned him down, but he was persistent, pleasantly so, without pestering you. And he was genuinely a prince of a boss, loved by everyone in the small firm. After 3 months of late night working after midnight, firm-wide akara or cupcakes for breakfast, helping you get better at modifying construction plans on CAD, all punctuated with mild teasing and mutual laughter, you agreed to have drinks with him. You ended up at his flat, the sex was tolerable and he fell fast asleep and for you. In a week, he declared his undying love. In a month, he proposed a choreographed and cloying public exhibition that came with the kneeling cameras and an expectant audience of strangers as standard. You couldn't say no. You fucked up us yesterday, Victor asked as he clamped your throat with one hand. Leave her. Release her, beg, Anele pleaded. He grimaced and squeezed. Answer me, but you couldn't talk. Your hands tried feebly to unclasp Victor's finger while your legs thrashed uselessly. Guy, you are choking her, leave her. Victor finally listened and drop-shoved you awkwardly on the armrest of the chair. Your weight toppled the chair over and you sprawled on the floor. You looked up to see people recording with their phones and Victor towering over you. You and Opal start talking. You started scream crying instead. Between body-racking sobs and streaming tears while rubbing your throat, you managed to blurt, how could you? How dare you assault me? You attacked me based on a lie and a lie? Yes, a filthy lie from the pit of hell. The words were armed by the appropriate doses of vehemence and righteous indignation. There's nothing between Opus and I. Victor nodded slowly, but his smile was bitter. He pulled his phone from his pocket, scrolled through it for a moment, and turned the screen to you. It was a video. Later, people would say Opunabo or Opus, the hedonistic maritime magnate, was your sugar daddy because he was older and wealthier. It wasn't that simple. Before Victor, you'd been on and off with Opus. It was a situationship, never quite switched on or off. It worked for both of you because there was no obligations or demands. And the sex fueled by Viagra and MDMA was mind-bending. Opus was fanatically about sex tapes. There were several tapes of both of you, but they were always with your consent, or so you believed. Yesterday, you'd honored his request to see him for the last time before the wedding. Looking back, the only sign he'd given that he was resentful about the wedding was when, in the middle of pulling down your skirt, he offered to pay you to call it off. It had been so unexpected and odd that you'd laugh it off as a joke, and he chuckled too. He'd sent the recording to Victor a few minutes before he arrived at Blue Elephant. You turned your eyes from the video, but the sounds of you moaning and talking dirty filled the air. You'd never talk dirty to Victor. Anneli snatched the phone from Victor's hand and stopped the video. Silence. There you were, still on the floor, skirt rolled up your thighs. There he was, his spirit crushed, his face wet with tears. The moment was long and hopeless, a preview of some external damnation. I'm sorry, Victor. That was all you could manage. Why? His voice goes soft. The Victor you knew. You sighed. Because this is who I am. You say, keep your money, say something intelligent. It confuses the man. What? You said you were willing to pay whatever I want so you can sleep with me, right? Well, I'm saying keep your money, say something intelligent instead, and I'll do you for free. He looks at you like you're crazy. You look at him like he's an olodo, till gradually the smugness drains from his face. You raise an eyebrow. I'm waiting. He opens his mouth, but apart from some erms and 2 false starts, no words came out. Oga, please, show me that you have some sense. Small sense, Sef. Your voice is now deliberately loud. It startles him, so he jerks back. He mistakenly hits the table, juddering your saucer, his phone and car key fob. In the restaurant, turns and stares. You rescue the teacup, bring it close to your face, and glance at him over the rim. You do realize that your money can't cure your stupidity, right? Like slow twisted metal, his beautiful face contorts into a murderous frown. Hey, yeah, fine man like you, but you're a blockhead. Tragic. Tragic. He mutters, bitch. Same to you, my sister. The man stands up quickly, grabbing his things. He glares at you for a long moment while you smirk. Then perhaps he realizes that no matter how far this went today, you'd always get the last word in. and each time would be more caustic than the last. Eventually, he trudges the walk of shame back to his friends. You hide your chuckle behind your teacup. The bald man in the corner smiles and looks away. That's when the man you're waiting for walks in. The last time you saw him was 3 years ago, and now he's all gray, coiffed hair and beard. He's a tall man, and his shoulders are beginning to stoop, but his eyes still twinkle, and his charm still works. You know this because before he makes his way to you, people go up to shake his hand, pay obeisance, and laugh uproariously at his quips. They know him here. They probably know him everywhere. Eventually, he's in front of you. You stand and hug him. It's a warm, fierce thing, and his hug back is tentative at first, before he clings to you and breathes in your hair. When you unclench, his eyebrow is still up in pleasant surprise. You shrug and smile like, uh-huh, I hugged you tight, so what? A waiter pulls a chair for him. Before he sits, he leans his gold-knobbed walking stick beside the chair. He sits, smoothens an imaginary crease on his impeccably styled etipo, and steps his fingers, showing off his gold, ornate cufflinks, watch, signet ring on his left pinky, and red chieftaincy beads on his right wrist. He searches your face and says, "Hello, prodigal." "Hello, BB." His name is Chief Buduma Benson, but everyone calls him BB. He sighs. "I prefer you call me Dad or Father." "Okay, BB." You both laugh. He notices the waiter ready to take order. He asks, "You want something to drink?" You shake your head. "Not really." He turns to the waiter. "Just some more hot water, please." "Hot water?" "For ginger tea, I carry a box in my handbag." He makes a sour face. It sounds abominable. "That's your wahala. Me, I like it." He notes to the waiter. "Hot water for my daughter. The usual for me." The man bows and disappears. You study each other unabashedly for a long while, then he muses. "You know, among all my children, you look like me the most. Really fascinating. Typical. It's God's favorite trick to play on fathers who have bastard children." You smile. "I like God's sense of humor." His smile is rueful. "You are not a bastard, and I always provided for you." You shrug. "True, but some things were more important than money." Your parents met when your mother was BB's secretary in his construction company. At the time, he was already married and the father of 3 boys. When your mother got pregnant for you, she went on maternity leave and never returned to work, even after you were born. She didn't have to. BB was the type of man who put his mistress's allowance and living expenses on his company's tab. But it came at a cost. She was to keep herself and you away from any spotlight. This meant that though you shared the same surname, you had to be guarded about your father's identity in primary and secondary school. Looking back, it wasn't hard to do because he was a phantom, ghosting in and out of your mother's flat in Eleka Hihaya Estate at night when you were already in bed or sleeping. And there were no pictures of him in the flat. The first time you remembered studying his face for a length of time was when you were about 6 or 7, and he appeared on TV along with the military governor commissioning a road or bridge which his company had built. "I did my best." You smile. If God forbid you have another daughter, BB, and she's the only child of her mother, and her mother dies when she's 11 in boarding school, and you send her to stay with her mother's only brother and his wife who maltreats her, and you never visit her, and you finally acknowledge her publicly when she's in her 20s because she's too big and too wild to stay hidden anymore, and you never did anything for her except send money, please don't tell her. Please, don't tell her that her ginger tea is abominable. You both chuckle over that, and he almost chokes in relief. The waiter comes with a teapot of hot water, a fresh teacup, and a saucer, a balloon glass half-filled with what you know is
cold rosé cognac,
BB's poison of choice. As always, whenever they bring BB's drink, you bob your head as you sing the hook in Busta Rhymes. And BB watches you bemused. Eventually, the drinks are set and the waiter leaves. You sip your tea. He gently swirls the brandy but doesn't drink. It must have been very hard for you. For a moment, you consider sharing a fraction of your considerable baggage, like how your first period came suddenly during business studies class in GSS 2, and the other children innocently cruel laughed as you leaked red and dashed to the bathroom, but there were no tissue paper, so you had to use your handkerchief and socks to stanch the flow, and you cried at first because you didn't know why you were bleeding and thought you were going to die, but later you didn't mind dying because maybe you'd see your mother again. Or like the time when you were 12 and you ran away from your uncle's house in D-Line and trekked across the railway and the food market across Aba Road at traffic lights up Nzimiro Street into Amadi Flats, because all you knew about Bibi's address was that he lived somewhere in Amadi Flats. And you were determined to knock on every gate in Amadi Flat till you found him. And at the fourth gate, an elderly woman let you into her house, spoke kindly to you, and gave you cold orange juice and shortbread biscuits. And while you ate, the police she'd called came, and you all got in her car, and they took you back to your uncle's house, and you would always associate shortbread biscuits with betrayal. Instead, you sigh and say, "You don't want to know the half of it." He searches your face for a long moment as some truths gently like earth sipping dew dawn on him. Eventually he whispers, "I understand why you hate me." You smile. "I don't hate you anymore, Bibi. You no longer have that power over me. God has fixed me." Orishi Jolomi. 2 years ago, you'd just been discharged from the clinic in Abuja. You stepped out of the private room where you'd spent 3 days into the corridor on your way out, a nurse by your side when he said, "I never thought we'd meet like this." You turned and there he was, in a wheelchair, vaguely familiar. "I saw you at Femi's housewarming party," he explained. He rolled up to you, "I'm Jolomi." He came to you, "Ah, yes, I remember you." 3 weeks before, striking man, magic smile, rough curly hair, fashionable stubble, and it seemed like both of you caught yourselves stealing glances at each other. Now he was broken, held together by casts on his right leg and left arm, a neck brace and a bandaged crown. "I am Ukela." "I know. You designed Femi's house and Alhaji Tuku's office. I like how you maximum small spaces." He winced slightly as he talked. "Thank you. What are you doing here?" "I get tired of staying in my room, so I take short rides with this." He patted the motorized wheelchair. "Looks like I'm next door to you." "I've just been discharged." "I meant, what happened to you?" "Accident. My car flipped 4 times. Thankfully, nobody else was hurt." "I see you've been in an accident or lost someone in one." "Lost someone. My mother." "How'd you guess?" "Something about your face when I mentioned the accident, and I sense things. I'm sorry about your mother." You chanted your rude response. "It's okay, it happened a long time ago." His eyes told you he didn't believe you. "What brought you here?" You smiled but didn't answer the question. "Take care, I guess I'll see you around sometime," you said as you left. You saw him the next day when you returned for a follow-up injection. After you were done on impulse, you asked the nurses if you could see him. You found him in the room on the bed. His grin when he saw you was big as life and made you smile. "I knew I'd see you soon." "Yeah, why that? Why is that? Yeah, why is that?" "I told you yesterday I sense things." You wondered how he read you easily. "Yeah, right. I was in the building, thought I should pop in and say hi." "Okay, keep me company for a while, please. Come sit." You went, you sat, you talked, and that was how your spoken routine of daily visits started. It was easy because the clinic was just down the street from your house in Wuse. Conversations grew longer every day, filled by ice cream from Cold Stone, which you snuck in for him. He had an addiction. Because he read you easily, silences were easy, excellent, and talking became part conspiratorial, part confessional for both of you. A week after you met, he admitted that he was an alcoholic and he'd been driving drunk when the accident happened. It was his second drunk driving accident in 18 months, and he feared he would not survive a third. That was when you told him about your seizure from the tramadol overdose, which had you admitted in the clinic. You also told him about the times you caught yourself as a teen. He asked if your overdose was deliberate. You said you didn't know. After a long silence, he said, "We have to choose if we want to live or die. Whatever we choose, let's do it. Do it with our chest." You wondered if he was joking. You watched them remove his neck brace and he twisted his head and beamed. You were there when he was discharged and sent home still with the cast on. You helped him remove all the alcohol in his house. You took him through a test for substitutes until he finally chose energy drinks and you discovered ginger tea. To lessen the odds of him getting drunk and getting behind the wheel, you got him to employ a driver. You watched him force himself to stand again, to walk small steps with crutches. You were there when they took the bandages off his head, leaving 3 heavy scars on his scalp, which meant a barber had to shave him bald. The loss of his hair distressed you, and it didn't help that he joked about it, calling himself Gurimapa. Eventually, he explained, "Laugh or cry, I can never grow a full head of hair. I might as well laugh." You told him about BB and your mother. You told him about the time when you were 7 and some boys had shot a tiny bird with their slingshots. The bird had swooped to eat something on the ground when they hit it. It tried to fly off with the one broken wing, but it careened and crashed, disoriented, by the front door of your mother's flat. You opened the door quickly, snatched the bird, and shut the door in the faces of the onrushing boys. From outside, they asked you to return their bird, and when you refused, they threatened to beat you when they next saw you. You didn't go outside for 3 days while you determinedly lost the bird, trying to force feed breadcrumbs and rice. You told him he reminded you of the bird. He asked what happened to the bird. You replied that it died. Jokingly, he begged you to stop nursing him. Your relationship grew to this nebulous thing. He intrigued you. You knew he was attracted to you, but it was frustrating that he never said or did anything about it. You still went on dates with other people, spent nights and weekends with them, and Jolomi knew, but you always returned to him like he was home. You spent a lot of time together. You'd even napped with him on his bed, cuddling him. He instructed his chef to cook meals for you daily, while his driver delivered them to you at work or at home if you weren't in his house. One night you lost it. It didn't help that you were slightly drunk and had just returned from a terrible blind date where the man kept trying to run his hand up your thigh under the table. You got to Jeremy's house and found him in his bathroom, leaning on one crutch in front of the mirror and using his free hand to sponge bathe himself. You hugged him from behind. He smiled at you from the mirror. You took the wet sponge from him. You sponge bathed him a few times before. You knew what to do. Still standing behind him, you clean him till you reach between his legs and his semi went hard, as always. Usually at this point, you smile at each other, say nothing, finish the bathe and let him dress. That day, you stroked him instead, running your thumb across the tape, watching him in the mirror as he groaned. "Stop." He held your hand. "What?" "Stop, please." His voice was stronger. "What the fuck, Jolomi? You think you're too good for me? I never thought or said that." "Then what is this nonsense? Everybody else would like what I was doing." "I like what you were doing, but I'm not everybody else." "Well, excuse me, Mr. High and Mighty. For the record, you're not all that, and you've got a small dick." He snorted. "But you were all over it a minute ago. So you're judging me now?" "For that, no. But for stupid shit like sleeping with people to get briefs when you don't need to, hell yes, I'm judging you for that. I knew it. I knew you always thought you were too good for me because you know my body counts. You're just like other men. Don't be silly." "Fuck you, Jolomi. You don't own me. I can fuck anyone I want, and I refuse to be slut-shamed for it. Yeah? Try to remember this the next time you complain that casual sex is ultimately unfulfilling. Or the next time you cry yourself to sleep about it. Don't worry, I won't say I told you so." You shook your head. "You think you're better than me. I think you're better than this shit. You're a smart woman, a brilliant architect, but right now the first thing, the main thing you know how to offer is sex. And when you meet a man who wants more than sex, who sees through all your shit and still likes you, you can't process it. Maybe it's because you really don't like yourself. Maybe that's why you always self-sabotage, like you did with Victor." He read the look on your face. "Wait. Wait, you thought I didn't know about Victor and why you relocated from Port Harcourt to Abuja? You don't know me. I know enough. Right now you are a cartoon, a stereotype. You are every girl with daddy issues. Fucked up childhood, check. Absent or uninterested father who you love, hate, but can't stop vying for his attention, check. Party girl and sex freak in public, check. Manipulative, depressed, self-harming, self-loathing mess in private, checkity check. What else have I missed? Oh yeah, you rock the biggest pity parties. Always feeling sorry for yourself. Always the victim. Life has been cruel to you. Yes, but your head is stuck so deep in your own arse, you don't realize you've been blessed too. Burdens and blessings, just like everybody else." He sighed and his voice went soft. "You're nobody's victim, you killer. I don't know how you're going to do it, God or therapy, but you need to unfuck your mind big time. Save yourself." "Oh yeah? Okay, Mr. Physician, who can't heal himself. Remember to save yourself the next time you relapse with your drinking. Don't worry, I won't say I told you so." You want to break down, tell him that of all the men who'd hurt you, he just caught you the deepest, but you steel yourself and lash out instead. You know what? Goodbye, Jolomi. I hope you relapse. I hope you drive yourself when you're drunk and you crash and die. Bibi hesitates before it comes out. I'm sorry. For a man like him, apologizing for anything is a big deal, but you shrug it like it's no big deal, and you search your soul, and at that moment it wasn't. Or maybe you were numb and didn't care anymore. Whatever it was, you didn't feel the familiar pain and you were thankful. As a man gets old, he realizes some of his mistakes. Some he can make right, some he can't. He sighs. Tell you what, when we finish our drink, let's go to the house together. It's time for you to finally meet some people. You're 33 years old and you've never been in your father's house or met his wife and your half-brothers. No, viewing Facebook profiles didn't count. You sigh. I'm not sure I want to meet your family. You shrug. I'm sorry, I don't know what to call them. They're family too. You roll your eyes. If you say so, Bibi. Then you say, this is a surprise. I'm not sure I'm mentally ready to do this, especially today or ever. He sips his
cognac.
Don't worry, they all know about you. Besides, you're not meeting any of the boys today. They don't live with me anymore, just my wife. I'll think about it. Regards you again. You look different. Content. You nod. I'm content. For the first time in my life, I'm still learning how to enjoy it. Anyway, I came down here and called this meeting because there's someone I want you to meet. Bibi raises an eyebrow with a half smile on his face. I see. I hope you chose well this time. It's the gentlest of rebukes about Victor. I used to be the queen of terrible choices, but for this one, I think I got it right. He can take care of you. You go all Destiny's Child. I make my own money, Bibi, and the frown on his face stops you. You exhale. Yes, Bibi, he can take care of me. He already does. And he loves you more than you care for him. Because us men, many times, you've been my father for only 2 minutes and you're already overdoing it. I swear I already miss the way we were. He wrinkled his nose. When you finish, please answer my question. I suspect so, but how do you measure these kind of things? You know. You'll know. So where is he? Oh, there. You point to the bald man sitting alone at the table at a corner of the restaurant, watching both of you while nursing a Red Bull. You signal for him to come over and he flashes his magic smile as he walks to your table. You do the introductions. This is my father. You can call him Bibi. Dad, this is Orisi Jolomi. Call him Jolomi.